Because of his delightful sense of humor, I share the following story with him and with you. In Israel, to cover the fighting, a young reporter decided to look for a human interest story in Jerusalem. She heard about an old man who's been going to the Kotel to pray twice a day, every day, for a long, long time. So she went to the Kotel, and there he was. "Sir," she asked, "how long have you been coming to the Kotel and praying?" "For 50 years. "What do you pray for?" "For peace between the Jews and the Arabs, for our children to grow up in safety and friendship." "How do you feel after 50 years?" "Like I'm talking to a wall." Professor, we are waiting to hear your words of wisdom.
Was there a hint about talking to a wall regarding this talk? My story is going to be better, but you'll only understand it at the end. I have a better. Let me explain. I'm in something of a predicament. The rabbi is here, and at some stage, we may have to ask him to, huh? Two rabbis. We may have to ask them to get up and leave, because I'm going to ask some possibly uncomfortable situations. And the first one is very simply, where do rabbis come from?
New York.
Yeah. having been born in both Brooklyn and New York, right, I can tell you that, yes, they come from there and many of them remain there. But what I mean, of course, is where do they come from in Jewish history? I mean, think about it. The Bible does not recognize and does not inform us about any such office or any such figure, right? There are prophets, there are kings, there are priests, right? There are Kohanim. You might say, but Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, right? I have news for you. Moses had to wait at least 1,000 to 1,500 years before he finally attained smicha and became Moses Rabbeinu. In the Bible, he is called Ha'ish Moshe, Moses the man. And not only that, what we'll see in a few minutes is that even after the biblical period, in what many of us refer to as the period of the Second Temple, where we begin to encounter types that are sages. You've all heard of the name Hillel, I assume, and Shammai, and so on. None of them, until after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, have a title before their name, Rabbi so-and-so. The title does not appear until after the destruction of the Second Temple. And that's an interesting phenomenon which I'm going to have to address. And so this is a problem. Where do they come from? And beyond that, who gave them authority? If the Bible doesn't talk about them, what is the basis for their role and for their position within the Jewish community? Another question. Since they came after prophets, did they consider themselves to be better than prophets? Did they consider themselves to be a lower status than prophets? What do we know about them? The fact is, I really could ask a question, actually. I'm kind of tempted. This is not a joke, although we always start jokes with a rabbi, a priest, and then did something, right? But this is not a joke. But I'm going to ask this question anyway. If you had to compare a rabbi with a prophet, a Kohen, and a Catholic priest, how would he differ from each of them? Start with the prophet. How does a rabbi differ from a prophet?
He's at a loss.
Huh?
He's at a loss.
Why is he at a loss? What you? Come on! I'm sure. Yes. Why? Why?
God doesn't speak to
me. That's what I wanted to hear. The rabbi does not base himself on revelation. Okay? He does not base himself on revelation. It has to come from within. From within, together with a tradition that he may have received from his rabbi. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage? Right. Depends if you're asking another rabbi, right? Or if you're asking a prophet. Let's keep that in mind. I'm not going to answer that question yet. How does the rabbi differ from a Kohen in our tradition? What is the difference? Yes?
It can be anybody, not family.
Exactly. A rabbi is not based on lineage. It's not based on ancestry. A Kohen can only be the son of a Kohen. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage? And we're not going to tell jokes about the guy who said, make me a Levi or make me a Kohen. You've all heard that. We're not. Right. Is it an advantage or a disadvantage to not have family background? Well, it depends on what society you're talking about. There are societies where yichus, right, where family background is very potent and very important. And people relate to you because you come from the right house. We have rabbinic stories, beautiful stories, where the head of the academy at Yavne after the destruction, Rabban Gamaliel, was deposed and they needed an alternative. They needed somebody to take his place. And there were a whole slew of prominent sages around, and whom did they choose? Elazar ben Azariah. And the Talmud says something almost, which we really have, I have trouble sometimes just, you know, accepting it. They chose Elazar ben Azariah because he's wise. Well, thank God for that, right? And he's rich. Right? And he's 10th generation from Ezra. His forefathers came over on the HMS Shivat Zion, right? Or something like that. But so yichas helps. But the rabbis are going to make a point of this, that in our world, that's not an issue. In fact, if you look at the sources in front of you, they make that point on source number 11 on the second page. And no way are we going to cover all of these sources today. But we're going to work with some of them. Source number 11, a bastard sage, meaning a mamzer, talmid chacham. A bastard in the technical sense, not a mamzer, right? But a bastard sage and a high priest, am haaretz, an ignorant high priest. The bastard sage takes precedence to the high priest, am haaretz. We don't care about lineage. The man can literally be illegitimate, right? But if he is a sage, he takes precedence to the Kohen Gadol, who is ignorant. I said you should compare him to a Catholic priest as well. What is the difference between a rabbi and a Catholic priest in terms of the function of a rabbi?
Not an intermediary.
He's not an intermediary. I can accept that, but I'd want to be a little more focused. What would a priest do that a rabbi is not only not required to do, not qualified to do, not required to do, and basically does not play that same role in Judaism? Rabbis hear confessions, I think, sometimes. It doesn't help. It may not score points for the confessor, as it were, in God's eyes. I'm sure many people pour their hearts out to rabbis for all sorts of reasons, and that's fine. But does the rabbi perform any sacred function? Can a rabbi sanctify a marriage? Can a rabbi effect any religious achievement by performing, let us say, a mass or something equivalent to that? Quite frankly, and I'm sure you all know this, I'm just using this as an introduction to formulate all the things that a rabbi, quote, isn't, before we decide what he is, right? So we said he has no access to revelation, he does not necessarily have yichus, and he has no powers of sacrament. In other words, it is not the rabbi that sanctifies a marriage. If I approach a woman and say, Harei at mikudeshet li, and there are two witnesses there, and right? The relationship is an acceptable one. That woman and I are married without the presence of a rabbi. You do not need rabbis to perform a wedding, right? Again, you know, contrary to what many people, I doubt if many people in this room, but there are certainly people out there who think that you do need a rabbi to perform a wedding. Let's go better. You know, do 9 rabbis make a minyan? No. No, they don't. In other words, the status of a rabbi in prayer is absolutely equal to the status of any lay person in prayer. So it's quite clear that the rabbi has a lot of shortcomings, or at least a lot of disadvantages, compared to these other types of leaders that we do recognize. Fact is that it is only after the destruction of the first temple that we encounter a functionary who is clearly not a prophet doing something. In the biblical period, the prophet did not just inform people of revelation. People came to the prophet on a regular basis to hear what he had to say in general. You may remember a story in one of the books of the Bible where a woman was granted a child after many years of being barren, and then the child dies suddenly, and she places him in an upper room, and she goes off to see the prophet, and her husband sees her. And the husband asks her, "Where are you going?" And she says, "To see the prophet." And the husband asks, "Why are you going to him today? Lo chodesh velo shabbat. It is neither Sabbath nor Rosh Chodesh." In other words, what is the underlying assumption? That people would go on the Sabbath or on the head of the month to listen to what the prophet had to say. But when we get to the post-temple period, prophecy dies out. For whatever reason. And the rabbis, by the way, are aware of this. They actually try to give it a date. If you look at the very first source on your handout, "This is Alexander the Great," or Alexander the Macedonian, "who reigned for 12 years. Till now, the prophets prophesied through the medium of the Holy Spirit. From now on," the Midrash says, "incline your ear and hearken to the words of the sages." In other words, the rabbis say that somewhere after the Second Temple, maybe at the beginning of the Greek period, after the Persians ruled, there is no longer prophecy. And instead of prophecy, sages begin to appear. The first account we have is a rather lengthy one. The earliest account of a figure that is neither a prophet nor a Kohen, and certainly not a king, but that nevertheless imparts wisdom, appears in a book that was written around the year 200 before the Common Era, 200 BCE, by a fellow called Ben Sirah, or Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus. I have to tell you something about this fellow. He, on the one hand, was a priest. He was a wealthy priest who lived in Jerusalem around the year 200, just before the Maccabees, just about 2-3 decades before the Maccabean uprising and the events leading up to Hanukkah. He left the book behind. He wrote a book, a beautiful book, part of which reminds us of the book of Proverbs that we have in the Bible, a book of wisdom. But it's also for me, the historian, a social mirror. It tells me something about society at his day. If I were to say that he was somewhat snobbish, I wouldn't be exaggerating. He hobnobs with the wealthy. Not only that, he really considers that wisdom is for the wealthy. You know, and we're going to talk about at the end of my talk, I'm going to get to a source. He thinks it's beneath common man to really deal with this. But if you look at your handout, he talks about these people whom he calls scribes. "The scribe's profession increases wisdom, whoever," but then he says, "Who can really be a scribe? Who can be what will ultimately become a sage?" And he says something that's rather offensive, I think, to us, but it may be offensive to the rabbis as well, even though he's lauding the rabbis. "Whoever is free from toil can become wise." You got to choose. Either you go to work, right, or you go to yeshiva, right? But you can only go to yeshiva if you have enough money to get through. There's no such thing as yeshiva, you realize that. How can one become wise who guides the plow, who thrills in wielding the goad like a lance, who guides the ox and urges on the bullock, whose concern is for cattle? In other words, he says, people who have to work for a living, they're not going to be wise. They can't do it. All these are skilled with their hands, each one an expert in his own work. Without them, no city could be lived in. Oh, yes, we need them so that society can get along. Wherever they stay, they do not hunger. But, now comes the but, right? They are not sought out for the council of the people, nor are they prominent in the assembly, nor do they sit on the judge's bench, nor can they understand law and justice. How different the person who devotes himself to the fear of God, to the study of the law of the Most High. He studies the wisdom of the ancients. He occupies himself with prophecies. He treasures the discourses of the famous. He goes to the heart of sayings. He's in attendance on the great, has entrance to the ruler. Remember this line. He has entrance to the ruler. He can show up before rulers. You'll see why this is interesting. Because the rabbis are going to say, we don't like this. Okay, he travels among the peoples of foreign lands, right? Of course, he must have sabbaticals and things like that, right? We know about that, right? To test what is good among and evil among people, his care is to rise early to seek the Lord his master, to petition the Most High, and I'm skipping, he will pour forth his words of wisdom and so on. At the end, let's flip the page. Many will praise his understanding. His fame can never be effaced. Unfading will be his memory. Through all generations, his name will live. The congregation will speak of his wisdom. The assembly, you notice this is wonderful, the congregation. They don't have to pay him a salary, right? Because he's a rich man. That's not what I meant by offending rabbis, right? And the assembly will declare his praises. While he lives, he is one out of 1,000. When he dies, he leaves a good name. This is the earliest account we have, that we possess, of a figure that is neither this nor that. He is a wise man who appears in society as such. But the criteria is he's got to be removed from daily, pressures of making a living. I don't know if you notice something that he does not say. If Ben-Sira were a Christian, he would have added to all of this one fact that is not to be found here at all. He would have said celibacy. He can't have a family either. Because a family intrudes. Exactly. And this is interesting. This would, of course, be the major difference between the rabbi and people that we will later on encounter as church fathers. And Ben-Sira is very careful to say he must devote his time. But of course, if he's wealthy, the family is not an intrusion because he can employ slaves or servants to take care of the family as well. A few years later, we begin to encounter statements issuing not from types like Ben-Sira, but from the sages themselves. The earliest sages, whom I will not call rabbis yet because they do not have the title rabbi, but they are quoted in rabbinic literature, in the Mishnah, for instance, we begin to encounter the first statements that they have to make about the ideal person. Look at source number 4 and then 5. Yossi ben Yoezer says, I'm sure many of you remember this from Tractate Avot. If you ever learn one tractate of the Mishnah, it should be Tractate, the teachings of the fathers. These are the ethical teachings. And it's very important to look at Tractate Avot for one reason. We were accused for years, in early Christianity in particular, Jews who adhered to the nature of Judaism that we all adhere to, we were accused of being legalistic, of being caught up in what? How to do this, how to do that, what yes to eat, what not to eat. We were accused for years of what? Of losing contact with the spirit and message of the prophets. And probably the best response to that accusation is to read the tractate known as the Sayings of the Fathers, which is an ethical treatise rather than any legal presentation. Yossi Ben Yoezer says, let your house be a gathering place for sages, wallow in the dust of their feet, drink in the words of with thirst. But right next to it, Yossi Ben Yochanan of Jerusalem says, let your house be wide open, let the needy be members of your household. Suddenly you find that the rabbis are going to assume, as opposed to Ben Sira, an affinity with simple folk. But look at source number 5. Shemaya says, the friend of Hillel, love labor, just the opposite of Ben Sira. Ben Sira said, you cannot be a sage if you're involved in labor. And now you find a major shift. A real sage loves labor, hates mastery, meaning hates being, right, lording it over others, as it were. And look at the last line, be not friendly with the government. So it's interesting. Ben Sira thought the great advantage of sages is what? You get to talk, you get to hobnob with the rulers, right? And now what does Shemaya say? Keep your distance. And of course he meant the Roman government at the time. Stay away from them. So what do you see? You see what we have here is a developmental process. Things are changing. The other issue was an issue of family. And the rabbis are going to make this point already in the days of Shemaya and Avtalio. Or at least later rabbis will claim that this point was made. So that along with Shemaya saying, love labor, hate mastery, and be friendly with the government, we read source number 6, which is a very nice little story. Our rabbis taught. A story of the Second Temple period. It happened that a high priest came forth from the sanctuary, and all the people followed him, because he's the high priest. He's the Kohen Gadol, and they all wanted to greet him. But when they saw the people, Shemaya and Avtalion, they forsook him and went after Shemaya and Avtalion. The people, the commoners, leave the high priest, and they go to greet the rabbis. And of course, the high priest was offended. Why should they leave me and cross the street to see those folks? Eventually, Shemaya and Avtalion approached him, the high priest, to take their leave of him, because they too respect the high priest as a high priest. He said to them, now you lead us, oh, let the sons of the nations come in peace. What is this? Shemaya and Avtalion were the descendants of converts. They have no Jewish lineage. And you realize what the high priest is doing. He's rubbing it in. Oh, welcome you sons of Gentiles. Right? In other words, what is the high priest doing? He may still be, he's a Kohen. For him, lineage is everything. If you don't have it, you have no claim to prominence. What do they answer? They replied, let the sons of the nations come in peace who perform the works of Aaron. Let not the son of Aaron come in peace who does not perform the work of Aaron. Which is beautiful. If we have to choose between being what? A disciple of Aaron or a son of Aaron, better to be a disciple. And sure enough, that's Mishnah 7, on source number 7. Hillel says, be of the disciples of Aaron. Now you have to understand something. This is very cute. When you talk about Aaron, and you talk about his brother, Moses, who do you think we would refer to when talking about disciples? Who do you think we would refer to when talking about sons? We all know that Aaron was the founder of what? The priesthood. So we would naturally assume that if the word sons appear, it would be what? Sons of Aaron. But since Moses is Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher, what would we expect? That the word disciples would be attached to whose name? Moses' name. What does the Mishnah do? It crosses you up. Be of the disciples of Aaron. And of course, you're undoing disciple rather than son. Be of the disciples of Aaron, loving peace and pursuing peace, loving people and drawing them near to Torah. This was the situation up until the end of the Second Temple period. What we know about this I would say proto or pre-rabbinic movement is, it had no official organization. It had no official title. These were people, I hate to use the word charismatic, but in a sense, and I certainly will not use it in the sense that it is very often used, in particular in connection to certain sects. What I'm talking about is a person who achieves a stature within the community by virtue of merit, personal behavior, and personal expertise and knowledge. They had no titles. The titles would only appear after the destruction, when at the same time we begin to hear for the first time about something called ordination. And here I have to be very careful how I say the next sentence. If you read Maimonides, the great medieval Jewish thinker, he will tell you ordination goes back in Jewish history, generation to generation, back to Moses. Moses ordained Joshua. And how do we know this? Because what does the Bible say about Moses and Joshua? It says that Moses placed his hands on Joshua. And the word in Hebrew is Vayismoch et yadav alav, from where we have the word Samicha. Somech means to lay hands on. And so the rabbis say, here you find Moses laying hands on Joshua. Smicha goes back to Moses. It's a beautiful idea. Unfortunately, I'm a historian and I have to dispute it. We have no evidence of the office of ordination, of the process of ordination, until after the destruction of the Second Temple. That's when it appears for the first time. If you look at source, I'm not going to read the whole source, but source number 12, Rabbi Abba said, at first, each of the sages would ordain their own students. For example, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ordained Rabbi Eliezer, and Yochanan ben Zakkai lives after the destruction, and so on and so forth. The earliest example that the rabbis could bring of ordination was Yochanan ben Zakkai and his disciples, and they are the first people to have the title rabbi. This is very interesting. You know we have the Talmud in printed editions today. Very often in our printed editions of the Talmud, you will have sages of the Second Temple period, of the earlier period, with the title rabbi. Rabbi Shimon ben Shattach, who lived 150 years before the destruction. I've got news for you. He received his ordination from the printers of the Talmud in Vilna in the 19th century. And how do we know this? Because when we go to the manuscripts of the Talmud, the title is always missing. In fact, we have different titles. Some sages in the Talmud are called Rabbi, Rabbi. Some sages in Babylonia are called Rav, without Rabbi, without the Yud, E at the end. Other sages are called Rabban. And then there are rabbis who have no title at all. And a 10th century head of an academy in Babylonia was once asked, what's the difference between all these titles? Why do some people have them, some don't? And he answered with a beautiful response. He says, well, Rav is a sage who lived in Babylonia, but the Babylonian rabbis did not have ordination. Rabbi, before a name, like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, that designates a rabbi in the land of Israel who received ordination. Rabban designates the patriarchs. You know that there was a family from the house of David that would become very prominent after the destruction of the Second Temple, and they would be the Nasi. The editor of the Mishnah is Judah HaNasi, or Judah the Patriarch. They're called Rabban. Then he comes out with his best line. But the earliest rabbis had no titles at all. Why? Because they were truly great. And you have to, the Hebrew here is beautiful, I'll translate. And he says, Harishonim, because the early rabbis, Shehayu gidolim be'emet, who were truly great, lo haya tzarich leravrevam. You did not have to pump them up with rabbi, right? Lo verav ve'lo veravi. And I must tell you how true that is. So what are they called? Hillel, Shammai. If you're really great, you don't need a title. Now, of course, the converse is also true. I don't know if you've ever seen books, rabbinic books printed in recent years, where the title page is not enough for all the titles of the author of the book. In fact, I have actually seen books where it says title of the page, title of the work, written by so-and-so, Harav, Hagadol, etc. Vichule, what does that mean? We have no room on the page for all of his accolades, right? Fill it in using your imagination, right? And suddenly you realize that something's happening in the rabbinic world. And this is a fact. On the one hand, the rabbis, in many ways, were the saviors of Jewish existence because they afforded us, or our forefathers, a means of maintaining their Judaism without a temple, without Jerusalem, even at times without the land of Israel. They created not just an alternative system, but in many ways, in their eyes, a higher system. A system that was spiritualized, that was mobile, that could address any issue in any land. And I have to be quite frank, if we're sitting in a synagogue today, it's because the rabbis, in fact, formulated, not that synagogues did not exist before the rabbinic period, they did. But the rabbis lent a very particular character to the synagogue, which is the one that we recognize today. So on the one hand, they contributed immensely to Jewish history. On the other hand, in their time, they were also problematic. Because the more that they became prominent, the more they became, what should I use so as not to be too offensive? They became institutionalized. They became, well, give me a word. Influential, that's okay most of the time. No, they became formalized. It became not only a calling, it became a business. You'll forgive me. And they became, in their own eyes, an elite, the intellectual elite. They became a learned aristocracy. And they may have been a learned aristocracy, but as long as you don't bandy it around and wave it around, you're okay. But we encounter, and what I love about it is, how do we know this? We know this from rabbinic literature itself, and this, of course, would be their greatness. One of the greatest things about the rabbis is they will identify their flaws and they will not sweep them under the carpet. So I have to praise them, but of course I have to also examine what their flaws might have been. And towards this end, I'd like to read with you one of the most brilliant stories in all of rabbinic literature. If I had time, we would sit here all day and just analyze it. But we don't have time. Go to the page before the end. The page that says on top, Rabbinic Self-Criticism 2. Right. I met earlier this week with a whole group of rabbis here in the community, and we devoted about 2 hours to reading this story. I know we don't have quite 2 hours today. We are limited now to another hour and 45 minutes, but have no fear. So you have the source in front of you. Our rabbis taught, a person should always be soft as a reed and not hard as a cedar. And now they're going to give me an example. It happened that Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon was coming from Migdal Gedor, from the house of his teacher, and he was riding on a donkey along the riverbank. And he was very happy and elated because he had studied much Torah. He chanced to meet a very ugly person who greeted him. Peace be unto you, my master. In Hebrew, Shalom Alecha, Rabbi. He, Rabbi Elazar, did not return his greeting, but instead said, Reka, empty one, how ugly you are. Are all the men of your town as ugly as you? Nice rabbi. Now remember when this is taking place. Immediately after he had come from where? Studying Torah. And the storyteller is very specific to make that point. He's still under the influence. Right? But the influence, exactly, I use that phrase very carefully. But under the influence didn't help him. And he acts boorishly. Are all the people of your town as ugly as you? But suddenly the ugly man opens his mouth. He may be ugly on the outside, but on the inside something else appears. He replied, I don't know. But go tell the craftsman who made me how ugly is the vessel you have made. Wow. Who's the real rabbi in the story, right? When he realized he had sinned, Rabbi Elazar, he dismounted from the donkey and prostrated himself before the man and said to him, I submit myself to you. Forgive me. Mecholi. He replied, I will not forgive you until you go and tell the craftsman who made me how ugly is the vessel you have made. He, Rabbi Elazar, walked behind him about a mile until he reached his city. And the citizens of the city came out and greeted him. Now, it's not clear if it's the city of the rabbi or the city of the ugly man, and we can play with this. I would like to believe it's actually the city of the ugly man. You'll see why in a few minutes. And he said to him, peace. They said to him, the same blessing, Shalom Alecha Rabbi, peace be unto you, master, teacher. He, the ugly man, said to them, whom do you call master, Rabbi? Who are you calling rabbi? They said, to the man who follows you. He said to them, if he is master, rabbi, let there not be many like him in Israel. Al yirbu kemoto. Because harbe in Hebrew means what? Many. So it's a play on words, and clearly the title rabbi comes off looking kind of bad. They said to him, why? He said to them, he did such and such to me. Now this is kind of cute. If I had time, I would play with you. He obviously didn't say the words such and such. He probably told them something. Now what do we have to do when we read this story? We have to go to the first part of the story and figure out what it was that he must have told them. And the storyteller is playing with us. He wants us to work for our money here. So what do you think the ugly man told the people of the city? He probably told them what? Well, even before that, I greeted him with peace be unto you, and he did not respond. B, he called me ugly and empty. He kind of insinuated that you also were like that. You know, he's trying to arouse their passions and win them over. Do you think he told them that the rabbi got off his donkey and prostrated himself and asked forgiveness? Probably not. Why? Of course, because had he told them that, they would have told him. So what do you want? Yes, he sinned, but he recognized his sin and he asked forgiveness. So he didn't tell them that. What did they tell him? And that's why it says, nevertheless, even though he was so terrible towards you, forgive him. For he is a great man of Torah. To which the man answers, for your sake I will forgive him, provided he does not make a habit of this. But that's colloquial English. The phrase in Hebrew is, ubilvad shelo yarbe la'asot kein, to continue doing this. And the juxtaposition is very interesting. A man may be a great man of Torah, but what we look at is what? Not the knowledge he knows, but what he does. What he does. How does the story end? Forthwith, Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon entered the Beit Midrash and expounded. Now, you notice what's happening. This is beautifully circular. Where did the story begin? He's coming from the Beit Midrash. Where does the story end? Goes back to the Beit Midrash. And, of course, one of the morals of the story is, these rabbis get along wonderfully as long as they're in their Beit Midrash. When do they get in trouble? when they start meeting the real world, right? Then we have a problem. But you know what? The problem might even be worse. So he goes into the academy, and what does he say? A man should always be soft as a reed and not hard like a cedar. Now, let me ask you, in our story, who was soft as a reed and who was hard as a cedar? What do you think the rabbi told his colleagues in the academy? Who was willing to be flexible? I was. I got off my donkey and I prostrated myself and I asked forgiveness. It's this guy. He wouldn't forgive me. He was hard like a cedar. And of course, you get the point. This story is beautiful because the storyteller is suggesting he still hasn't gotten it, the rabbi. Even when all this happened, once he goes back into the academy, he's lost again because the learned elite, the learned aristocracy, look down on people. This, by the way, is a beautiful story. If I had time, I would show you how the same words appear in every almost every line. If you look at line 6, is everybody as ugly as you? And the word is kimotcha. If you look at line 13, al yirbu kimoto. Or for instance, the vessel in line 6, how ugly is the vessel you made, asita. Look at line 15, kach vekach asali. Look at line 7. Forgive me, mechol li. Look at line 16, mechol lo. This is a beautiful work of art, of literary art as well, where the two parts actually correspond. But of course, what interests me is that these stories tell us something about the rabbis, that they were probably their own greatest critics. I think for our society, and I would say this very guardedly, but I think we've seen, certainly in other religious contexts, how problems within the clerical world would tend to be swept under the carpet. And you can all maybe guess what I might be referring to. I think we have a major lesson to learn from stories like this, where rabbis are aware of the fact. Now let's go, and I'm going to end very shortly, I think. Yes, but look at source number 5 on page, where are we? The previous page, right? It doesn't have 4. The page that has on the title, Insiders and Outsiders. Where the Talmud asks a very interesting question. Why is it not usual for scholars to give birth to sons who are scholars? And this is true. In Babylonia, it was true. In Eretz Yisrael, less so. In Babylonia, it is very rare for prominent rabbis to have sons who are prominent rabbis. I mean, the first generation of rabbis in Babylonia, there are two fellows. One is called Rav, the other is called Samuel. Samuel had no sons at all. He only had daughters, and they died at an early age for all sorts of reasons. Rav had a son. His name was Aibu. He's the first great rabbi of Babylonia. And there's a beautiful story where Rav tells his son Aibu. It's in beautiful Aramaic. I know you may not understand it, but you should prepare in Aramaic if you're going to see Mel Gibson's movie. Right. Tarchi bach bishmat avela istaya milta ta agmerech mile de alma. I tried teaching you Torah. Didn't work. Let me give you some good business advice. Right? And he tells, you know, buy cheap, sell expensive, and some big advice, right? And it's true, the rabbis don't have sons who are rabbis. And the Talmud asks, why is that? Rav Yosef said that it might not be maintained that the Torah is their legacy. I hate to say this. How much more time do we have? Do I have time for another little story here? Look at the last page of your handout. This relates to another beautiful story, and I thought it's kind of it's the flip side. In fact, actually, we ran them off as flip sides. It's the other side of the coin. Rabbi Yanai was, about another rabbi, and it begins, Rabbi Yanai was walking along the way. In other words, he was walking in the marketplace, and based on the previous story, as soon as we find a rabbi walking in public, what do we know? Uh-oh, we're in trouble. And he saw a very impressive man, meaning a very wealthy man. This is interesting. It's just the opposite of the other story. In the other story, he saw an ugly man. Now he sees a very impressive man. By the way, you realize what the upshot of the first story was. You don't judge people by first impressions. The only thing he knew about that man before calling him an reka, an empty man, was what he was ugly. And that for him was enough. And so here he meets an impressive man. And he said, he tells the wealthy man in good third person, would the rabbi care to share my hospitality? And that's because rabbis talk to one another in third person. Now, how does he know he's a rabbi? He's very impressive looking. He's judging by what? First impressions. The man replied, what pleases you? He's talking second person. Rabbis don't talk to one another with you. They say him or thee or what. You is basic common language. You know what it's like in German? You would never use du, right? You would always say sie, right? Do is considered improper. So I imagine Yanai, when he hears you, is, He, Rabbi Yanai, brought him, the wealthy man, to his house, fed him, gave him drink. He then examined him in Bible. You know, would you like to say a word of Bible? The man didn't know. In legend, Agadah, he did not know. In Mishnah, he did not know. In Talmud, he did not know. The man is ignorant. He doesn't know anything. And Yanai realizes, I made a mistake. But maybe there's some saving grace here. The word grace is used on purpose. He said to him, please sit and say the benediction, probably the Birkat HaMazon, right? The man says, no, let Yanai bless in his house. It becomes apparent that what else doesn't he know? Not only doesn't he not know Talmud and Mishnah and Bible, he doesn't even know Birkat HaMazon. Yanai then said, are you able to repeat what I will say? The man said, yes. The man probably said that, thought Yanai is going to say some impressive benediction and it'll follow. He said, say as follows, a dog has eaten Yanai's food. If you don't know this, if you don't know that, if you know that, you're a dog. To which the man replies, the man arose, caught hold of Rabbi Yanai and said, you've taken my inheritance and refused to return it to me. Yanai asked, what inheritance are you talking about? What are you, crazy? What have I stolen from you? He said, I once passed by the schoolhouse and heard the children recite a scripture. Now, this is kind of cute. Three lines before, he didn't know any scriptures. Now, suddenly what? One scripture he knows. And, of course, it's going to be the scripture that nails Rabbi Yanai, right? Right? Moses has commanded us Torah. Torah tziva lanu Moshe morasha. Kehilat what? Aha. And the point is what comes after the word? It is the inheritance of the community of. The scripture says Yaakov. What does the man say? Moses commanded us Torah, the inheritance of the community of Yaakov. Somehow, the inheritance of the community of Yanai is not stated, but the inheritance of the community of Israel. In other words, Yanai, I know why you invited me to your house. Because what did you think? I was one of your buddies. I was one of the guild. I was one of the fraternity of rabbis. And you only invite your own kind. But I've got news for you. The Torah belongs to everyone. It is the inheritance, Morasha, Kihilat Yaakov, of the community of Jacob, of all of Israel. Did the rabbi get it? When they made peace with one another, the rabbi says, what merit have you had that you deserve to eat at my table? Still haven't gotten it, right? It's merit to eat at this boor's table who called somebody a dog. To which the man says, well, yeah, I do have merit. I never heard an evil word about someone and passed it on. I never said nasty things about people. Or if you wish, I never called anybody dog. Nor did I see two people fighting with one another without attempting to restore peace. I make peace among people, whereas your whole behavior seems to be in what direction? Distinguishing between groups. Now go back to that source that we started reading. Why don't they not have sons who are like them? That's number 5 on that earlier page. Rav Yosef says that it might not be maintained that the Torah is their legacy, which is exactly the essence of that previous story. They think it belongs to them. Rav Shisha, the son of Rav Idi, said, here we have a son, the rabbi of a son of a rabbi. But there are no streets in all of Israel named after Rav Shisha. He's not the most prominent guy in the world. Okay. That they should not be arrogant towards the community. Another rabbi, Mar Zutra, says, why don't they have sons like them? Because they act high-handedly against the community. And the last rabbi says, Rav Ashi, one of the redactors of the Babylonian Talmud, because they call the people asses. Well, not always asses, sometimes dogs, right? But you get the point. So look how far we've come. The rabbis realize there's a danger in this. Right? You're going to fall into the same pit that the priests fell into. What? They had a lineage of what? A family? You're going to try to create a lineage of learning which will close you up from society. They were sufficiently knowledgeable to realize that that can't happen. The fact, if I am proud of something, it's that stories like this appear in the Talmud. Right? The one place you would not expect to find them. The one place you would expect to find what? An idealized, cleansed, censored material. You find stories like this. I think the image of the rabbi is probably one of the most unique developments in Jewish history because, as I say, it has no scriptural basis. It was something that was created ex nihilo, out of nothing, to meet the needs of the community. I'll stop with this, except that I promised that I would have a story that's better than yours. And this is just to let you out with it. You'll see why it's related. I was told of a man who once entered a pet shop in Israel, and he didn't have much money for a real pet, and so he figured he would buy a parrot. Well, tiny thing, you know. And he enters. This happens in Bnei Brak, you have to understand. And he asks, please tell me, I'd like to buy that parrot there. Can you tell me how much it costs? And the dealer says, I'm sorry, sir, you can't afford that parrot. $10,000. Are you crazy? $10,000? What does this parrot possibly do that it's worth $10,000? It knows all of Talmud by heart, backwards and forwards, right? This parrot knows Shas Kol. Well, I really can't afford him. And he's looking around. What about that parrot? Sir, this is even more ridiculous. Believe me, you can't afford it. $20,000. What could this parrot possibly know that it's worth $20,000? He knows both Talmud and all of Maimonides backwards and forwards. He can recite Maimonides at the drop of a hat. This man is at a loss. What can he do? Finally, he sees his little parrot on the side, very inconspicuous, and he says, okay, I'll take that one. To which the man, the owner says, sir, if until now this was ridiculous, now we have really, this is insane, forget about it. We're talking here about $500,000. $500,000? What could this parrot possibly know that's worth $500,000? So I'll tell you, sir, I really haven't the slightest idea what it knows, but the other two call him rabbi, right? We'll leave on that.